Civil Law Committee is called to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. Can I have a motion for the minutes from the 21st? Representative Holberg moves minutes from the 21st. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. First bill we're going to have up, members, is item C on the agenda, which is House File 2467, Representative Lieblings. Representative Liebling, there's a delete all amendment labeled the DE3. In order to get the bill in the shape, the author desires all in favor of the DE3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. To your bill as amended, Representative Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you. Good morning, members. This is a bill from the Office of the Inspector General, and so I have a testifier here who can begin. Jerry Kerber, who is the Inspector General, is not here yet, but we're expecting him shortly, but we can start walking through the bill.
Why don't you go ahead and do that, Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Reggie Wagner. I'm with the Department of Human Services. Would you like me to just briefly do the section by section on the delete all three, the DE3?
That sounds like a good idea. Thank you.
Okay. Section 1 establishes a definition of authorized fingerprint collection vendor. And this is part of the new enhanced background study that the department is developing. And we are trying to add some clarifying definitions and terms to both distinguish from our current background study system, NET study, and to try and highlight where we are moving the system and coming up with the new terms and formats for it. The Section 2 defines our current study, NET study. Has been in use since July 2004 and is an electronic system. Section 3, I'll hand the mic over.
Ms. Wagner, you did fantastic.
Thank you. I was afraid I would have to start telling jokes.
Yeah, and members, I'm not sure if we want to, if members really need us to go through an 18-section delete all, if we're not just here stalling for time now that Mr. Kirby's here. I'm not sure that's the most efficient way to talk about the bill, but if everybody just kind of, I know there is a PowerPoint. Were you going to use the PowerPoint and distribute
it? Mr. Chair, members, first of all, I mean, to apologize. I was involved in a separate crisis issue. I'm sorry I got here late. But I think what, I'm Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services, Inspector General's office. And this is one of our major proposals this year, so thank you very much for taking it. I thought what I might do is just give sort of a high-level overview of what's going on, and then we can kind of go based on the will of the chair and members as to how deep you want to go into the separate issues.
Why don't you go ahead and do that, Mr. Kerber. We do have two other bills on the calendar, so I'm conscious of time, but why don't you proceed with your idea as you proposed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe I'll just direct you to one of the handouts that you have. Has the title is Data Practices Related Changes in the DE3. It's a two-sided page. And so, first of all, this is a redesign of our background study system at DHS, but what's not changing is important to know. We're not changing who we're doing studies on, when we're doing studies, what causes people to be disqualified, and it doesn't come anywhere near those issues about who gets to set aside of a disqualification, who doesn't. None of that stuff is touched in here. What we're talking about in this bill is really the infrastructure and the way that we do these background studies. There's about 275,000 background studies that we do a year, and they virtually are on everybody who provides direct contact in healthcare and human services. And so what we're trying to do here is to increase the accuracy of these background studies. And by increasing the accuracy, there are better protections for children and vulnerable adults. The employers are going to have a much more streamlined hiring process because it's going to go much faster. Employees are going to be able to get hired much faster, and they're going to be able to move from employer to employer much easier and actually initiate their own background study. And then at DHS, because of the efficiencies, we're going to actually have some decreased costs over time. And so what we're hoping to do is to come back to future legislature with a fee change that's actually going to lower the cost of these studies. On this handout, we address four things, data retention, data security and access, accountability, and the privacy notice. And these changes are really the result of our having talked with nearly 70 different presentations that we've given in meetings, and we've talked with over, 1,500 people. Virtually anybody who wanted to hear about our background study proposal, we've met with them and have heard their concerns. One of the things that we removed in this bill, in the DE3 amendment, was the expansion of our background studies to include more FBI record checks. There's concern about the fact that the FBI, when we give the FBI fingerprints for purposes of a background study, they retain those fingerprints. And so we're not, and that was a concern that we heard about, and it's not really ready for the short session, the full discussion. We get that. So we removed that from the bill, and we're hoping to talk about that in future sessions. We're not going to retain some of the provisions we have in here. Just real quickly, we're not going to retain fingerprints at the Department of Human Services or even the BCA. We're going to keep a photo at the Department of Human Services, but we're only going to keep that for 2 years after somebody's no longer affiliated with any of our programs. The photograph seems to have some allure we've heard about in the driver's license database system, so we've got some automatic destruction schedules built in. We also are going to allow people to ask us to destroy their background study data if they're no longer affiliated with healthcare, human services. There's no need for us to keep it. They'll be able to do that. And we have some automatic destructions after 90 years.
90 years?
90 years, yeah. So in the Data Practices Act, it says that's the date at which data on decedents, data on decedents becomes public at 90 years. And when, instead of making this information public, we're going to destroy it, is where we got that lead from, talking with Don Gemberling. There's a lot of data security built in. It has to meet the FBI standards. It has to meet the BCA standards, minute services. We're going to be auditing from DHS. We're going to oversee a lot of auditing that's going on. There's going to be control of access to all the data fields by even all public employees, DHS employees. We'll have to have their own background study, fingerprint-based background study done. But each of those, every data field that they'll have access to is going to be controlled at that field level so that people have access to only the minimum amount of information that they need access to. We're going to have the data encrypted at the database level, and the data is going to be encrypted at every point of travel. And every one of these provisions is outlined in this bill. We are going to make sure that if in this new system where employers are going to be able to look up an individual to see if they've had a background study done already, every time that occurs, the individual is going to get a notice from us mailed to their last known address. And at any time, an individual can also contact us and say, I want a list of all the employers who have initiated a background study on me in case our last known address isn't accurate. And I think Mr. Chair, I'll stop there. I think we have another provision here that says that anybody who uses our system, including the fingerprint vendors and the users out there, the entities that use our system, are going to be subject to the same civil penalties under 13.08. And then the privacy notice requirements in our bill are really beefed up significantly after talking to Representative Holbrook. So we will be telling everybody really everything that's going on with this data, even the things that aren't changing that we've newly learned. So that's kind of the bill, and I can kind of go into the individual sections to the extent Chair desires.
Mr. Kerber, questions from members. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerber, just wondering, how does DHS know when a person is no longer affiliated? What alerts the system that they're no longer affiliated?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, what we have built in here, based on some, building on some of the language the legislature passed last year, is a roster system. And so in the definitions, there are rosters. There's an active roster for the employer, an inactive roster, and then a master roster. And so every employer out there is going to maintain a roster. The record-keeping system is really within our NetStudy 2.0. So all record-keeping requirements that they've had in place and different licensing requirements are going to be addressed in the system that they're going to be using to initiate these background studies. And so they will essentially keep an active roster. If they want to hire somebody, they put that person on their roster. And when the person leaves, they take them off their roster. And so that roster is how we know that somebody's currently affiliated with somebody. And that gets to be important because that's the basis, that's the list of people against which we're going to compare new criminal records we get or new maltreatment records. We're going to be comparing those against people who are actively involved and actively affiliated with an employer out there.
Thank you.
Ms. Scott. Any questions from members? Person Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerber, a couple questions, and I appreciate the time that you and your staff spent with me over the interim, and I can see a lot of my concerns reflected in the bill, and I appreciate that. Excuse me. Just a couple questions. The destruction under Section 14, the destruction of the background study subject information, why do you require at least 2 years to lapse? In other words, say I do a background study, I'm moving to Florida, it hasn't been 2 years, I want my, you know, private stuff that's floating around DHS in Minnesota gone.
Yeah.
Why do you need, why can't the data subject at any time ask for the destruction?
Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, we came up with that 2 years because this is also, this data is also evidence that employers have done what they're required to do. And so when we monitor licensed programs, we're also monitoring to see that they're complying with background study requirements. We tend to be on a two-year cycle with employers. And so when we're going out to an employer today, we want to be able to review that they've done background studies in the previous 2 years according to the standards in the law. And so it's really for that employer accountability that we need to keep it, not so much the individual.
Okay. And if I might... that kind of leads to my next question. Why? It looks as though a data subject would not have to provide permission for somebody to look their background study information up. In other words, you require an audit trail, and you allow for a study subject to request a report of who's been looking at them, but it doesn't, I mean, it would seem as though if I was seeking employment that I could, in order to control the use of my data, I could contact the Department of Health and say, let nursing home Z look at my background. Why is it flipped the other way?
Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbert, the way the kind of our background study works is there's sort of a behavioral consent to the person that to initiate a background study. When somebody applies for a job, they're told by the employer that they're subject to our background study. The privacy notice that we provide for them to give, and the employer has to sign off on verifying that they have given the individual our privacy notice, kind of explains the whole works. And the individual at any time can opt out. Now, if the employer is logging into our system to initiate a new study and finds out that the person has already had a study and so it's essentially done, they only can do that after they've documented in the system that they've provided that privacy notice, that they have paid the fee, if there's an applicable fee, and that the individual has given them the individual social security number as sort of the consent to see previous studies that have been done. And so there isn't really another consent that they have to sign, but it's sort of those three steps have to be met.
So just for clarification purposes, employer could not access the system and surf, if you will, that their inquiry has to be based on a social security number and a permission submitted by the data subject.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, that's correct. And then even if they did, every time that somebody goes into the system, we're going to mail a notice to the individual at the last known address that this employer, ABC Child Care, ABC CD program, has inquired about your background study status in our system. They're going to get a notice in the mail. Now, given that we might not have, you know, the most recent up-to-date address for people, they also can make a request to us at any time asking for a complete list of all the employers. And so that will be included in the privacy notice, too, so hopefully they'll remember that down the road a ways.
Okay, and then just real quick, if I may, again, in the Section 14 on page 11, how would there ever be a situation where 90 years have lapsed from the creation of the data that would be a longer or later situation than 90 years have elapsed from the person's birth?
Mr. Kerber?
I don't understand that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, you know, what we tried to do is to come up with something that had a destruction, right, a destruction schedule. Currently, there is no destruction schedule at all for our background studies data, so we keep it forever, which is really a long time. And so there really is no need for us to keep it for, you know, 1,000 years. I mean, so what we came up with is this, we sort of following the language in the Data Practices Act about data on decedents, thinking that, well, at least 90 years, we'll presume if we have information the person is dead, we'll destroy the information. Otherwise, we'll use a 90-day figure to destroy the data. It could be shorter. We certainly have some people who are volunteers in programs that we regulate, like adult daycare programs, or people volunteer in nursing homes, and they're, you know, they're up there in age. Maybe not so many in their 90s, but there are some in their 80s. But so, you know, that year could be shortened.
Well, I'm just more concerned about the interaction of presumed to be dead if 90 years elapsed since the creation of the data, which, let's say, the earliest you do this is when they turn 16, so they'd be 106.
Okay.
Or 90 years have elapsed since the individual's birth, which kicks you back to their 90 years. I don't get why you need both of those. Why don't you just say 90 years since the individual's birth? Because I don't think you ever get to 90 years since the creation of the data, because they're going to hit the age of 90 years since birth before that.
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I see your point. It makes sense, yes.
Did you want it? Well,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I absolutely see Representative Holberg's point, but if you just took that out, you'd be saying the individual's presumed dead if 90 years have elapsed since their birth. I don't think we want to say that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think this is something that can be fixed right here, but I don't think the interaction between those two standards even works. So there's got to be something a little better, and I don't want to waste the committee's time on it this morning, but it just doesn't make sense to me.
Right. Mr. Chair, okay, we'll work on that.
Between here and eight and your committee, Representative Liebling? Okay, thank you. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kerber, you mentioned that not going to be checking at the FBI because they keep the fingerprints. Question I have is, if we have somebody that comes from out of state or may have had an incident out of state, if you don't check with the FBI, how are you going to find out that information?
Mr.
And
Kerber.
To give them the fingerprint.
Mr. Chair, and members, what the... Under the current law, we do about 18 to 20,000 FBI record checks a year, and we do those on everybody who provides child foster care services and adoptive parents. But then there's also this other group that, for whom the BCA record indicates that they're a multi-state offender. So if somebody has a criminal record in Minnesota, we can see from their record whether this is the only state where they have a record, or if there's another state where they have a record. And if they're a multi-state offender, then under current law, we obtain their fingerprints and we do an FBI record check. That will continue. And in fact, almost this law has to pass in order for that to continue, because the FBI is now saying that we can't get that information from them anymore without our query to the BCA being based on fingerprints. So, but we have in place that. It's an imperfect system, because you have to first be an offender in Minnesota before we find out that you have an offense in another state. However, with our new system, one of the things we're also going to be doing is, this is part of a national background study system that we're implementing here with the federal grant. We're going to be looking at other states for purposes of the sex offender registries in all the other states. And so we'll be able to at least get at the most serious sex offender crimes in other states, maybe not everything. There are a couple provisions also, like a nursing home. If somebody, when we're doing a background study on somebody and the address that they give us is not Minnesota, then we automatically also check that other state too. But it's an imperfect system, but we plan to come back with a proposal that will have us do FBI record checks actually on everybody.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking to see where I can find it, and maybe you can help me find this. But I see where the background study subject can request a for the destruction of the data. Mm-hmm. The question is wherein is the subject notified that he has that ability? Where is it in the, I can't find it anywhere where it actually says that if I'm applying for it, that I actually get told that I have that right and have that capability. I guess that's what I'm looking for, because it doesn't help me very much if I have that ability and I never know it.
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howe, if that is not included in the privacy notice section, we can make sure that it is. That's on page 8 is where the requirements for the privacy notice get expanded. You're right. I don't see that as a requirement. I mean, we will include it, but there would be some comfort in statutory directive to us to do that. And so we can work on an amendment for that.
Thank
effect.
You. Thank you.
Representative Liebling, did you want to respond to something previously?
Oh, yeah, thank you. And I just want to respond briefly to Representative Johnson's comment. And just to point out, members, that this is sort of the dilemma we face in so many of these issues, that there is a good public policy reason to do these fingerprints that I think Representative Johnson is pointing out. On the other hand, it comes with a lot of costs to privacy. And the idea that we're going to send people's fingerprints to the FBI just because they want a job, and the FBI is going to keep those fingerprints forever, gives a lot of us a lot of heartburn. And yet, if we want to participate in the system and have, you know, kind of the Cadillac safety system for our vulnerable patients who are served by DHS employee or background screened people, then we may have to do that. So it just kind of highlights the dilemma that we all face when we are dealing with these issues.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kerber, I'm not sure if I heard you right. Did you say something about that you'd removed language regarding the FBI record checks or something to that effect?
Mr. Kerber.
Did I hear that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, what I was referring to is that our original proposal, and as it sits in the Senate on the floor, is that as we're proposing to roll out this new background study system, we're proposing that we would convert over to fingerprint-based criminal record checks on everybody. But at the same time, we were proposing that we would do FBI record checks on PCAs. So we would start by our expansion that will ultimately include, our proposal will be, to do FBI record checks on everybody that we're doing a background study on. But to start with, we were going to do it on PCAs. And we were picking PCAs because they're a pretty transient group. They move a lot around a lot. They have a lot of jobs, and they'll be a really good group for us to study for purposes of determining cost. All additional costs in here, this bill is cost neutral, and we're building this infrastructure essentially with federal grant money. And so there's no general fund appropriation. It's costing money, to be sure. But so as we come back to the legislature to try and sustain the system that we're developing here, we're going to have to come up with a different fee structure. And as I said, we think the fees are going to go down, but we're going to have more elaborate studies that are going to be done ultimately. But we were starting with the PCAs, and that's what's removed here.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for the testifier or the bill's author? Seeing none, then Representative Liebling renews her motion that House File 2467, as amended, be referred to Committee on Health and Human Services Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Liebling.
Thank you,
Mr. Kerber. Literally hot off the press. Representative Hillstrom?
Oh,
Oh, do you want? We didn't call ourselves representative. Oh. Mr. Chair, did you want Representative Putley to go on? Did you want him? Okay. Okay.
Oh, you got it. Representative Yaruso, it's my understanding that this bill will go to the General Register, so the Chair moves that House File 2546 be moved to the General Register. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, there is an amendment, A14. I'd like to move that.
Oh. Representative Yaruso moves the A14 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the revisor's bill, which is to correct things that have been found in statute that are erroneous, ambiguous, omitted, obsolete references, redundant, conflicting, superseded provisions are removed, and miscellaneous corrections to laws, statutes, and rules are made. And I have Michelle Timmons with me to testify to the bill.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, I'm Michelle Timmons, the reviser of statutes, and this is the annual reviser's bill that corrects errors from past sessions. The bill has two articles this year. The Article 1 is a number of miscellaneous corrections, and Article 2 relates to cleanup and corrections in the pensions area. Mr. Larry Martin, the director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirements, is in the audience and will be available to answer any questions in the pensions area. And with that, I would stand for questions.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? With that, Representative Yaruso moves that the bill be re-refer House File 2546 to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Huntley, it's my understanding that they're still photocopying your bill. So if you would like to start talking about it, or would you like us to recess and wait for your bill? Representative Huntley. Representative Huntley, welcome to the committee. It's my understanding that your copies of your bill are still being copied. And so my question is, would you like us to recess till we get the bill, or would you like to start talking about it while we wait? Representative Huntley.
Let me we would prefer to just start with the bill and save a little time if we can.
Sure. Is there any member of the committee that objects to him starting to describe it's like a 120-something page bill, 144 pages? If anybody objects to him starting to talk about it, Representative Holberg.
Yeah, I'm sure. I don't object, but is even the bill summary available?
I'm checking. We'll check. There is a summary, so we'll get that for you. Welcome to the committee, Representative Huntley. Please go ahead.
This is the department's omnibus finance bill, and I know that you're just mainly interested in the privacy parts of it, so we have Mr. Sullen from the department to describe what's in the bill as far as privacy is concerned.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead, and if you could please let us know which sections are that they should be looking at, so for clarity, members are just getting copies of the bill.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Sullen. I'm an area manager at Hennepin County, and at Department of Human Services, I'm serving as project chair for the North Star Care for Children. I'll be addressing provisions in Article 3. These are technical corrections to North Star Care for Children. You may remember North Star Care for Children was enacted last session. It unifies benefits for children in foster care, in relative care, and in adoption assistance. It eliminates, by doing so, it eliminates barriers to children acquiring a permanent family in situations where they can't be reunified with their original family. And in particular, there are sections here regarding background studies and court proceedings that I think this committee may be of interest. You've just been listening to discussion on the bill that Representative Liebling had regarding background studies. These are the same background studies that are used here. If the discussion that we just had was about how background studies are conducted, this is one of the applications, so when they are used. In sections 1 and 2 of Article 3, this adds federally required background studies. These are the same as current practice for child foster care, but they would be new for kinship assistance. It also amends statute to permit the commissioner to conduct a federally required background study in the unusual case where the prospective kinship relative custodian is not already a licensed foster parent. Again, those are in sections 1 and 2. And these are to meet federal Title IV-E requirements. Federal Title IV-E is used extensively in North Star Care for Children. There are also provisions in here regarding court proceedings. They're adding federal requirements for court proceedings for transfer of physical and legal custody. These are in sections 6, 14, and 15. There are kind of three main points here. First, it defines the required court findings at a permanency hearing when transferring permanent legal and physical custody to a relative. Secondly, it permits the court to defer finalization when necessary in order to determine eligibility for North Star kinship assistance. And finally, it adds documentation of the required agency, required of the agency's efforts to the out-of-home placement plan for court review. Again, those are in sections 6, 14, and 15. There are various other provisions. I'm not sure which other ones you would be particularly interested in, but I think that one that I would draw your attention to, not meeting federal requirements, but in order to streamline processes, in sections 3, 4, 7, 8, and 16, it eliminates time-consuming and redundant processes to support timely permanency, specifically if a background study has already been conducted at the time that the caregiver is being licensed as a foster parent. Those same background studies don't need to be repeated at the point that they're seeking approval to be a relative custodian or an adoptive parent. Often it's the foster parents who end up becoming the permanent families for children, and those background studies would not need to be repeated. The department has found that in the two-year period, 2012 through 2013, that 2,510 individuals were subject to both a child foster care background study and then a subsequent adoption background study in that two-year period. I think those are probably the main provisions in Article 3 that this committee would be interested in, but I'd be happy to take questions or address other sections.
Questions from members? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just on Article 5, Section 1, you're adding, can you tell me what you're doing there?
I'm sorry, Representative Holberg, I missed it.
Article 5, Section 1.
Is there someone here to talk about Article 5, Section 1? Uh, Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Holberg, this bill has, as you, I know it's just landed on our desks here, but it has sections that are really from different parts of DHS. It's kind of a conglomeration. And so that section you just asked about is completely, maybe you already realize that. I'm just sort of suggesting, Madam Chair, maybe we should sort of go in order and not hop around, because we'll probably confuse ourselves no end on this very confusing bill.
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair, Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services again, and I can answer Representative Holberg's question, I believe. Representative Holberg, what's being done here is that this is a provision of the Data Practices Act 1346 that governs licensing data and investigative data that we maintain. And so what's being done here is simply adding 245D in there. Last year, the legislature created a new license category, license under Chapter 245D, the Home and Community-Based Services. And so this is just kind of bringing those kinds of licenses and all of their data into the same system that we have for classification of data, what's confidential, what's private, and what's public.
Representative Holberg.
And so if I might, if on your page 75 of your bill, starting on line 8, all of that still remains public.
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, I'm not sure I have the same version of the language that you have.
Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, there is no real change to any of the classification. It's really just bringing another, the new provider type. Some of these license holders were licensed under Chapter 245B in the past, and now they're licensed under 245D. So it's adding that reference, but what was public before is still going to be public. What was private before is still going to be private, and what was confidential is still going to be confidential.
All right, thank
and
you.
I can explain that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's good.
Other questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Melinda Hugdahl with Legal Aid. Our concerns are with Article 3 of the bill, which Mr. Sellin just talked about, which relate to background studies and placements of children. And the bill addresses two significant policy changes in the area of child protection and background studies. And how background studies are configured is a significant factor in where children are placed in reality. The first change in the article of the bill you've heard about is related to the fingerprinting under the bill to be considered as a placement in any of the possible outcomes you would now need to be fingerprinted. The second change is related to placements primarily with relatives, what they call transfers of legal custody. Under this bill, it significantly changes how transfers of legal custody to a relative are handled, and we believe it will have a significant and unnecessarily negative impact on children. All of us want to have kids who are placed in a safe environment. We also know through experience and research that many children in the child protection system do better when they can be with a relative that they know. And so Minnesota law has a lot of examples in this chapter where we have made attempts to try and place children with relatives and family where that's safely possible. And our concern with the bill is that it completes a fence that's going to exclude a lot of those relatives. And the children in those cases may then need to go to foster care instead of with a relative that they know. And this really gets to the issue of federal requirements. And I look at Representative Holberg because I know there have been many discussions about what's federally required. And that's kind of the nut of what we're getting at here. To receive federal foreign money to help pay for the placements of these costs as part of North Star, DHS has indicated that a federal requirement is to do background studies on the relatives, these transfer of legal custody cases. However, in the bill, what will disqualify the relatives is a creature of state law, Chapter 245C, which is far more expansive than the federal guidelines of what should require to be disqualify a person seeking placement. The federal disqualifiers, I think, are things we would all agree on. Felony convictions for child abuse and neglect, spousal abuse, any crime against a child, crime of violence, assault, or battery. State law disqualifications, which this bill specifically applies to transfer of legal custody to relatives, are far broader. Chapter 245C, as the department's indicated, is the same chapter that's applied to all licensing studies. We are now putting another group of placements in foster care into that pot. We also know, and a lot of you know from hearing other bills, that Chapter 245C allows consideration for non-convictions. So we'd be looking at arrest records, police reports, those kind of things, which just broadens out from what the federal requirement is. They include additional offenses that are broader than the federal standard, things like writing bad checks, possession of burglary tools, forgery, things like that would now be coming into play to disqualify a relative from having the child be with them. So here's an example of how the language would impact the cases. And I'm going to use an example that actually was a call I got from a legislative assistant, not from anybody on the committee, who called me, a constituent call. So let's say grandma calls and says her daughter, who's a parent of two, has chemical dependency issues, is drinking too much, maybe using drugs. She indicates the county may be getting involved soon, and mom's just been arrested. She's very concerned about her grandkids. She's no involvement with mom's issues, and she's been trying to get mom to get help for quite some time. So here's what happens next. It may be possible that the kids are placed with grandma as an emergency placement. That's a short period of time. Under the bill, grandma will need to come in and get fingerprinted, and that's a federal piece. Let's assume grandma's background study shows that she wrote a bad check 3 years ago. Under existing law, grandma could still pursue a transfer of legal custody because the standard for the court is whether it's in a child's best interest. So the court is looking at those cases individually. This language changes that. Grandma will be disqualified. If the children were placed with her on an emergency basis, they must be removed and put into foster care. Grandma cannot be considered as a placement for the children because she's disqualified. The county has no particular reason to keep her in the realm. Grandma's only option is to seek a set-aside from the DHS licensing hearing and appeal process. That is outside of the child protection realm. It's a separate process grandma would have to enter. Grandma must fill out all of the DHS paperwork requesting a hearing and the reason why she should grant a set-aside. And in our experience, the general set-aside from background study to getting a set-aside takes 6 months. The permanency has to be decided in a year. And the unfortunate part about this is that even if grandma, who's now been outside of the process of what's going on in child protection, potentially for months, comes back in, the reality is when the court is looking at state stability of the kids and permanency, if the children have been in a foster placement for 5-6 months, that is a really uphill battle for that relative to now climb. So we are really concerned that this functionally has a piece there, and I think it goes too far. I don't think people have issues about having a background study in a more structured way. I think, as you all know, once changes go into statute in this area of law, it's very, very difficult to pull back from that and get changes made. The bill could be amended to make foster care and relative custody assistance both use just the federal standard, which would be a change not only in this piece of the bill, but would have to be further amended. It could happen. Or Article 3 could be deleted, and we could come back next year, hopefully, with a better way of doing it. So we do recognize, and the unfortunate piece of this is that North Star was done in a way to help get federal 4E money to help even with relative custody assistance cases for those what they now are calling guardianship assistance payments. And without the piece, even having the federal background study disqualifier, we're not going to be able to access those funds until we have some kind of background study in place. We understand that. It's just the problem is that the bill isn't the federal requirement of what they consider disqualifying offenses. It's this. It's 245C. So that's our concern with the bill. And so that's we think it's going to really negatively impact some of these cases, and that's our concern. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wonder if, first of all, I'd like to ask Ms. Hugdahl where we'd have to amend it, or maybe we can do this offline, but I'd kind of like to also hear the DHS response to what she just said so that we can get really clear, because I'm very concerned about what she just told us.
I am too, Representative Liebling, and it's based on child protection court cases, so this is going to have to be heard in judiciary as well. And so I'd like to hear what the department has to say about it, as well as Representative Huntley. So, Mr. Kerber?
Madam Chair?
Representative Holberg.
I have a question for Ms. Hugdahl.
Sure. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the current way of doing mm-hmm. these types of things, are those taken, the example, are those items taken into consideration? In other words, you, as you stated, though, like the forged check would be a disqualifying factor. Currently, how we handle it, is the court also aware of those elements, and they're just to be considered in the best interest of the child?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Hugdahl.
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, under current law, what typically would happen is if Grandma, let's say, wanted to be take the route of getting a foster care license, and she had this disqualifier, that would show up. But she would also have the option of looking at a transfer of legal custody. So the court would be aware of the fact, likely, of the, what was going on. But the reality is that they could look at the transfer of legal custody statute now, which just says it's a placement in the best interest of the child. So the court could consider that piece of it in whether a bad check or whether, I mean, and I want to be clear, too. Some of the 245 disqualifiers are the same thing that disqualify you federally. So we're not having an argument here about whether who have serious offenses should be disqualified. So I think the shift here is that it's really changing how the court looks at this, and by creating kind of a parallel piece of it, you know, that's a concern. And I think the reality too is, even if we could speed up the set aside process as part of it, you know, you still have that point in time where you're now asking the relative to go into kind of a separate proceeding. That part is not something that's granted by the court as part of this, because the background study and you have a right to appeal and all those pieces. I think, you know, in the other bill we talked about that, about how foster care and some of those provisions are under that. So we have some of that happening now because foster care is set up that way to get a foster care license. This was an additional piece for some relatives to also, within the juvenile court system, stay into that process, and this would change that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair, members, Jerry Kerber again. Just to respond to a couple of those scenarios that Ms. Hugdahl mentioned, what has to happen here is that under the federal requirement, the background studies that are done for this situation have to be the same as the background study that's done for foster care. And so because of that, what we do is we're bringing in the other law, the rest of the law. Now, it doesn't mean that the law, the background study law, Chapter 245C, couldn't be changed to address foster care background studies in some way that would then affect this too. But it would be pretty significant if we're talking about a removal and shifting around of what kind of crimes cause people to be disqualified. Those kinds of discussions have not really kind of played through in the legislative process. There have been bills over time that you may recall that have sought to sort of remove a crime as a disqualifying characteristic, and it hasn't really gone well. But it certainly that can be the discussion, but it's kind of big for right now. The other thing is that I just want to mention that these are situations that do get expedited on our end. And so if somebody has they've forged a check, for instance, and it's a disqualifying characteristic, that isn't necessarily the defining event for that person for the rest of their life. It's a disqualifier, certainly, and for 7 years, depending on the level of crime. But that person can request reconsideration of that. And there is a requirement in the background study law that we consider these placements with relatives when we're making these decisions. These are the ones, they come with a county recommendation, too, so we're going to be aware of the relative placement issue in these cases. And certainly, we try to expedite these. When we've done background studies in foster care and there's a placement issue, we've had staff meet people out at the curb to get their fingerprint card from them. So, I mean, and we've run them through while people have waited in our lobby. We've done FBI record checks. And so we're really trying to facilitate kids being placed appropriately. And there isn't any requirement in the law to that effect, but, you know, that's another amendment that maybe could say that the commissioner shall expedite these cases for purposes of placement of children with relatives. I mean, we could always work out some kind of amendment to that effect.
Mr. Kerber, what would be the consequence if we deleted that section from the bill and didn't implement it this year? Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair, members, I think the...
Salen, is that your
name? Salen.
Salen, Mr. Salen.
The consequence would be the loss of the Title 40 revenue for kinship assistance, since it's that we're trying to accomplish this in order to get the Title 40 funds for the kinship assistance component. As Ms. Hugdahl indicated, that's kind of the point. And as Mr. Kerber indicated, it's we need to match the foster care requirements to the kinship assistance in order to get the Title IV fund.
Representative Huntley, any comments on Section 3? Representative Huntley?
Well, it sounds like it would have a fiscal note. I think we could look at some kind of amendment, and I understand you would like to see it in the Judiciary Committee.
Representative Huntley, if it makes a change in the way the courts determine placement of children, we have to see it. So, I mean, we certainly can, you know, figure out how to make sure you meet the deadlines of whatever you need, and we can hear it tomorrow. But if it has an impact on how the courts are determining placement, we have to hear it. Mr. Stalen.
Madam Chair, one thing I would say is that the characterization of it preventing a transfer of permanent physical legal custody would not be accurate. What it does is it adds this as a consideration because that's the step where eligibility for kinship assistance is determined. It makes it possible for the court to defer finalization if eligibility is a question and needs to be determined. But it doesn't prevent the transfer of custody. What it does is it means if this hasn't accomplished, then they're not eligible for this particular benefit.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I ask one more question of Ms. Hugdahl?
Sure, Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hugdahl, I understand your concerns about the process, but do you believe that there should be a lower standard for relative placement than for foster care placement? In other words, should we have a higher standard in place for if we were going to put a kid in foster care versus with grandma and grandpa?
Ms. Hugdahl.
And if so, why?
Ms. Hugdahl.
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, I think there are folks who work tremendously with people with relatives who feel that there is some difference. I will tell you that, in a way, actually, it's kind of a moot point. Because the federal funding pieces tell us that you have to have parallel provisions. So some of this was created when North Star was put into effect and kept that piece and didn't take the federal standard when we had the opening to do it. So when we say it's federally required, what's federally required as a disqualifier, the feds just want to see that their disqualifiers are there. When we put North Star in place and went beyond that, we set this scenario up, essentially. So I think the distinction is that, and I think the piece of it is that's concerning, and we're happy to talk about an amendment to the bill, is how do we do it where we're also, even on an expedited basis, we're still requiring, in this case I'm talking relatives because that's the provision of law that's changed in the bill, we're still putting them into a separate process with the Inspector General's division, and we're not taking care of this in the juvenile court process, which is where it's handled now. And I'm not sure how to change that without changing the foster care piece. That's kind of the crux of this. And I apologize, and I, you know, that this is, because it's in the omnibus fiscal bill, had we been more aware that this was coming, we certainly would have had discussion about this sooner. So that's the best answer I can kind of offer you of kind of how we got here. So I think even if folks wanted to have a different standard for relative placements, as opposed to that, we have to tap 4E money, which everybody wants to do because it'll help provide more funding stream in for these families who are taking children in, whether they're relatives or not. We have to meet that requirement. So the question is that this just doesn't seem like the right way to do it.
There's other questions. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. More of a comment. I hear two statements that concern me when what we're dealing with is trying to do permanent placements for kids, and one is that this discussion is too big to have, and the other is that, maybe 7 years having to wait is kind of not a big deal. And I realize those were kind of just made in passing, but it kind of gets to the heart of the matter, because we're talking about permanent placements for kids, and 7 years is indeed a very, very, very big deal in the life of a little kid. And the idea that it's too big a discussion to have when we're placing kids' lives just strikes me the wrong way. So I really hope you can get it straightened out before it comes to judiciary.
Representative Pugh.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kerber, I'm just so concerned about, the length of time here. I think I heard, if I'm not mistaken, Ms. Hugdahl speak to this one-year period at which that this typically takes, 6 months, to resolve. And that sounds like there's a deadline of a year, and then is that... I'm not really clear about this. If you could just speak to this window of opportunity that we have to place children potentially with family members, which seems like, certainly the right thing to do. And it just seems like all of these layers of bureaucracy, I don't really understand, but just really worried about this. Can you just clarify a little bit?
Madam Chair and Representative
Mr. Kerber.
The issue of the timeline that I think Ms. Hugdahl was referring to is sort of the length of time, the maximum length of time if somebody is mm-hmm. sort of appealing multiple times through the process. So basically the way this works is that, and I'll talk about the 7 years thing too, is that when we do a criminal record check, we look at people's records. And certain crimes have different relevance. And so if it's a misdemeanor offense, it's going to be relevant for 7 years if it's on the list. Some gross misdemeanors are relevant for 10 years. Felonies are relevant for 15 years, and then there's a group of crimes that's relevant no matter how long ago the person committed that act. And what that means, when I say it's relevant, that means that the person gets disqualified if it's within that period of time. But the individual has an opportunity to argue two things. One is that we got the wrong information. But the other one is that, notwithstanding the fact that they may have committed that act in the past, today they don't present a risk of harm for this situation, and this is why. Those reconsiderations come into us, is what we call it. It's a request for reconsideration, or a request that we set aside a disqualification. And those we can do those relatively quick. In some cases, people have a hearing right. And I think Ms. Hugdahl was referring to those that might have a hearing. And so if somebody has, if it's a finding that's made, our disqualification is at the same time as if it's a finding of maltreatment maybe by child protection or adult protection, then they have a hearing right to challenge that maltreatment finding. And that can delay the process. It's, people schedule these things as quickly as possible, but the hearing itself might take some time. Or if we've disqualified somebody based on the other notion she said is a preponderance of evidence that they committed an act that they haven't been convicted of, there's a hearing right that they have in that case. But in these cases, those situations, those would come into play if we do not set aside a disqualification. If we don't agree that, with the recommendation of the county, that this is a good placement issue and we should allow it to occur. Now, and it doesn't mean also that it can't occur as this process is playing out, like when we disqualify somebody who's working in a nursing home or a child care center or chemical dependency program. Generally, those people can work while we deal with the disqualification issue. Not all the time. It depends on what it is. But sometimes they can work in a setting under supervision of another employee. Sometimes not. In this case, we'd be relying very heavily on what the county is telling us. Is this a good situation? And sure, we've got to resolve this background study issue, but it doesn't need to interfere with actually a placement that's underway.
Well, Representative Pugh, I just want to make it clear, though, that it may, and that there are permanency within the court. There are timelines for permanency of children through the court system. And so we're going to hear this issue in judiciary.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I'm looking around this room. I'm probably the only one in this room that's actually had to go to somebody's house and actually physically remove the kids and take them away. One of the hardest things there is to do in some situations. some situations, it's the most grateful thing you can do, and especially when you see the kids about a week later for the first time with smiles on their faces, and they're happy, and they're clean, and they've been fed well. So it's a tough decision when law enforcement goes to take a child away from their parents. And I've also seen how well it is when the family members get involved and take custody of the child. In fact, I have a relative doing that as we speak at this time, and how wonderful it is to keep that person, that child, in with the family unit. Representative Huntley, I'm wondering if there's a way we could get an amendment in the bill that if one of these disqualifiers come up involving one of the relatives, it'd be an automatic review of that disqualifier, and see if we can work that way. So as soon as that disqualifier shows up, there's an automatic review being done, so we can get this process expedited and still be able to tap into some of the federal money.
Representative Huntley?
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm certainly amenable to having them sit down and try to work out an amendment that would make this a little simpler and make sure that it's expedited so that, that there's no delay in the decision.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Kerber, I've got a couple questions about just how the process works here. In terms of the right to set aside the disqualification, I'll just fire them all at once and you can answer. The first one is, I assume that there's no right to an attorney there, right? I mean, it's a civil matter. There's no specific right to an attorney. They can't afford one. They've got to go find one, legal aid or someone else. That's the first question. The second is, can you tell us what is the standard of review or what is the burden? Just frankly, from an evidentiary standpoint, what is the burden on the person trying to set that aside? I mean, I just have a picture in my mind, and maybe Ms. Hugdahl can enlighten us, although she's got an obvious bias, but it seems like it would probably be a really steep mountain to climb, it seems, but I'm interested in what the legal standard is. And then finally, you talk about the role of the county, and I'm led to believe that maybe there's some collaboration going on, and maybe as a practical matter, there's some understanding, but as a legal matter, is the county's recommendation entitled to any weight? Or is it, in essence, the department's decision? Maybe practically speaking, you consult the county, and if Hennepin County says grandma's okay, or, Coochiching County says grandma's okay, that's one thing. I know as a practical matter, that's one thing, but legally, is it entitled to any weight?
Mr. Kerber.
Okay, Madam Chair and Representative Simon, first on the attorney issue, what generally happens when we disqualify somebody, it's up to them. I'm not sure what percentage of people actually are represented in these cases. We provide a notice to the individual that includes a form, and it's a form that asks questions like for them to explain really what the disqualifying event. What the standard in the law is to us is that when we review these cases, there are like 8 variables that we need to look at and consider as factors. How many disqualifying events are there? How long ago did it occur? What was the harm suffered by the victim? How similar is the victim of that crime to the people receiving services where that person wants to work? What evidence of rehabilitation the person has had? And a few others kind of along those lines. And when we review that, in these particular cases, when it involves foster care or anything involving a county placement issue, the requirement is that the county gets a first look at that, and then they attach their recommendation to us. And so then the county's role is significant in this with their recommendation. Plus, as I mentioned before, the law also directs us to also consider if it's a family-based placement, too, that we need to be a little bit more open to the values of family placement that might not be present with the, some people call it stranger care. But so then the standard that's in the law is that preeminent weight must be given to the health and safety of people receiving services over the interests of essentially anybody else. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we have to focus. But certainly all those other recommendations play a significant role.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so if I'm understanding it correctly, as a practical matter, you collaborate with the counties. But legally, the buck really stops with the department. You're not required to give the county recommendation any particular weight, either in statute or otherwise. Is that basically right?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, that's right. Ultimately, the decision is made at the department.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Kerber, so if you make a disqualification based on the change in this statute, does that preclude the judge from finding that it's a proper placement, or is it ultimately just a disqualifier based on your report? Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair, I think as Mr. Sullen was answering the similar question earlier, I think that this doesn't have anything, any bearing necessarily on the placement decision. What it has a bearing on is the benefit decision. So if 4E funding is going to be made available to support this arrangement, the background study issue has to be resolved. But if the background study issue is not resolved, it just means that there wouldn't be 4E funding.
Mr. Kerber, I believe the confusion is whether that is really the impact. So if that's the intent, that if you pass a background study, you're eligible for money, and if you don't, the placements can still occur, but you're not eligible for money. If that's the intention, I don't think that's what it says.
Okay. Madam Chair, maybe we can clarify that.
Ms. Hugdahl.
Madam Chair, and one of the reasons I'm looking confused is, and I hate to put another iron in here, the reality is if you are disqualified from having a placement, you're disqualified. I mean, just if it's a serious offense or a minor offense, if you actually look at the payment provisions of receiving guardianship assistance under North Star, what disqualifies you from receiving payment is actually the federal disqualifiers. What's being changed in the bill is the substantive law regarding transfers of legal custody. So if there's a difference of opinion on that, we can work that out. But I think we may just see this kind of differently. But that's part of our concern with the bill. In addition to the fact that we may have a relative, grandparent, aunt, uncle, who just wants to have their grandkids with them, and we're telling them that they have to go into the DHS licensing process and go get a set aside, even if it's expedited. We are making that change. That is a huge policy shift.
Other questions from members?
All right.
So I would make the motion to re-refer House File 3215 to the Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance. All those in favor signify. What? Ms. Representative Liebling? Okay. Ms. Hugdahl?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I just, because I was tracking the path of the bill, I thought it was scheduled to go next this afternoon to Representative Liebling's committee. So
Are you planning to hear it this afternoon, Representative Liebling? Because I can hear it tomorrow.
I think, yeah, actually, Madam Chair, it is scheduled in my committee today, I believe.
No.
Or tomorrow. I'm not sure.
I believe it's this afternoon.
It is. Yeah.
Representative Portman, sorry.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering who has the bill. If civil law has the bill, then, and you're planning to hear it this afternoon, Representative Liebling, then I imagine yours is an informational hearing.
Representative Huntley, is there a clone of this bill?
There's two bills moving around that are identical.
So
and I'm not sure which one is going to policy. Okay.
So, Madam Chair, since
Representative Portman,
we can't move this bill to Representative Liebling's committee today because it has to transfer on the floor at noon tomorrow. I think the right motion is to move this bill to your committee because either she has custody of a different bill that she's going to hear today.
Okay, wait a second.
Or we can change the motion on the floor also.
Wait a minute. So, I will renew.
I think she's going to check her agenda to see which House file she's got scheduled.
Okay.
Representative?
Madam Chair, I'm told it's not this actual bill. It's the clone that's coming to my committee. So, you can do whatever you like with this one.
Thank you. I will move to re-refer House File 3215 to the Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Huntley.
With that, Mr. Chair, we adjourn.
We are.
With that, we're adjourned.